This is Kathy coming to you with the Decatur Herald and Review for Wednesday, November the 5th. Big headline today, ex-VP Dick Cheney dies at age 84. Dick Cheney, one of the most powerful and polarizing vice presidents of U.S. history, dies at 84. Dick Cheney, the hard-charging conservative who became one of the most powerful and polarizing vice presidents in U.S. history and a leading advocate for the invasion of Iraq, has died at 84. Cheney died Monday due to complications of pneumonia and cardiac and vascular disease, his family said Tuesday in a statement. The quietly forceful Cheney served father and son presidents, leading the armed forces as defense chief during the Persian Gulf War under President George H.W. Bush, before returning to public life as vice president under Bush's son, George W. Bush. Cheney was, in effect, the chief operating officer of the younger Bush's presidency. He had a hand, often a commanding one, in implementing decisions most important to the president and some of surpassing interest to himself, all while living with decades of heart disease and post-administration a heart transplant. Cheney consistently defended the extraordinary tools of surveillance, detention, and inquisition employed in response to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Bush called Cheney a decent, honorable man and said his death was a loss to the nation. History will remember him as among the finest public servants of his generation, a patriot who brought integrity, high intelligence, and seriousness of purpose to every position he held, Bush said in a statement. Years after leaving office, Cheney became a target of President Donald Trump, especially after his daughter Liz Cheney became the leading Republican critic and examiner of Trump's desperate attempts to stay in power after his 2020 election defeat and his actions in the January 6, 2021 riot at the Capitol. In our nation's 246 history, there has never been an individual who was a greater threat to our republic than Donald Trump, Cheney said in a television ad for his daughter. He tried to steal the last election using lies and violence to keep himself in power after the voters had rejected him. He is a coward. In a twist, the Democrats of his era could never have imagined, Cheney said last year he was voting for their candidate, Kamala Harris, for president against Trump. A survivor of five heart attacks, Cheney long thought he was living on borrowed time and declared in 2013 that he awoke each morning with a smile on my face, thankful for the gift of another day, an odd image for a figure who always seemed to be manning the ramparts. Fixed with a permanent half smile, detractors called it a smirk. Cheney joked about his outsized reputation as a stealthy manipulator. In his time in office, no longer was the vice presidency merely a ceremonial afterthought. Instead, Cheney made it a network of back channels from which to influence policy on Iraq, terrorism, presidential powers, energy, and other conservative cornerstones. Fixed with a seemingly permanent half smile, detractors called it a smirk. Am I an evil genius in the corner that nobody ever sees come out of his hole? He asked. It's a nice way to operate, actually. A hardliner on Iraq was increasingly isolated as other hawks left government. Cheney was proved wrong on point after point in the Iraq War, without losing the conviction that he was essentially right. He alleged links between the 9/11 attacks and the pre-war Iraq that didn't exist. He said U.S. troops would be welcomed as liberators. They weren't. He declared the Iraq insurgency in its last throes in May of 2005, back when 1,661 U.S. service members had been killed, not even half the toll by war's end. For admirers, he kept his faith in a shaky time, resolute even as the nation turned against the war and the leaders waging it. But well into Bush's second term, Cheney's clout waned, checked by courts or shifting political realities. Courts ruled against efforts he championed to broaden presidential authority and accord especially harsh treatment to suspected terrorists. Bush did not fully embrace his hawkish positions on Iran and North Korea. From the beginning, Cheney and Bush struck an odd bargain, unspoken but well understood. Shelving any ambitions he might have had to succeed Bush, Cheney was accorded power comparable in some ways to the presidency itself. That bargain largely held up. As Cheney put it, I made the decision when I signed on with the president that the only agenda I would have would be his agenda, that I was not going to be like most vice presidents, and that was angling, trying to figure out how I was going to be elected president when his term was over with. His penchant for secrecy and backstage maneuvering had a price. He came to be seen as a thin-skinned Machiavelli orchestrating a bungled response to criticism of the Iraq War. And when he shot a hunting companion in the torso, neck, and face with an errant shotgun blast in 2006, he and his coterie were slow to disclose that episode. "It was one of the worst days of my life," Cheney said. The victim, his friend, Harry Whittington, recovered and quickly forgave him. Comedians were relentless about it for months. When Bush began his presidential quest, he sought help from Cheney, a Washington insider who had retreated to the oil business. Cheney led the team to find a vice presidential candidate. Bush decided the best choice was the man picked to help with the choosing. Together, the pair faced a protracted 2000 post-election battle before they could claim victory. Recounts and court challenges left the nation in limbo for weeks. Cheney took charge of the presidential transition before victory was clear, and it helped give the Republican administration a smooth launch despite the lost time. In office, disputes among departments vying for a bigger piece of Bush's constrained budget came to his desk and often were settled there. On Capitol Hill, Cheney lobbied for the president's programs in halls he had walked as a deeply conservative member of Congress and the number two Republican House leader. Politics first lured Dick Cheney to Washington in 1968 when he was a congressional fellow. He became a protege of Representative Donald Rumsfeld, Republican from Illinois, serving under him in two agencies and in Gerald Ford's White House before he was elevated to chief of staff, the youngest ever at age 34. This article reads, Lake Decatur continues to retreat amid drought conditions. Almost a month after residents and businesses were asked to cut back on their water consumption, Lake Decatur continues to be at low levels amid drought conditions. We're still under voluntary conservation, and we appreciate that people are doing their best on that, said Robert Wheel, water production manager for the city of Decatur. As of Monday, Lake Decatur is at an elevation 3 feet lower than the desired winter pool elevation for the year, Wheel said. There is more than 4 feet left to go until either of the water plants would be significantly affected. The lake is the main water source for both Decatur and Mount Zion residents. Wheel said city officials will be meeting on Wednesday to look over the updated information on the drought conditions and the risks associated with determining if further, more mandatory restrictions will be necessary moving forward. Rebecca Koppel, meteorologist and atmospheric scientist with the National Weather Service in Lincoln, said conditions indicate severe drought in the area and that the next update on conditions will be coming out Thursday. A drought monitor map showed a large portion of central Illinois is already under severe drought conditions with below average rainfall since August. Due to this, municipalities may also be implementing outdoor burn bans, while farmers and the agricultural industry could be feeling the impact more than regularly. Koppel said that in 2024, there were drought conditions across central Illinois as well, but not nearly as significant as they are now this year. Pay attention to what your city and county officials are instructing, whether that is with water usage or any local burn bans that are in effect, Koppel said. Some tips include operating washing machines and dishwashers only when full, taking shorter showers, being mindful of letting water run when washing hands, brushing teeth, or shaving, and considering car wash businesses instead of washing at home. Wheel said he encourages people to get water leaks fixed, not just for the drought, but to have work done before it gets too cold outside and to not have the added financial burden of a monthly water bill being higher than expected. This headline reads, the city of Decatur needs more of our money, but it doesn't want to take it. The Decatur City Council really needs about $1 million more of property taxpayers' money to balance the books looking ahead of 2026, but council members aren't thrilled at the prospect of having to take it from them. The number crunchers and the council's professional staff presented a resolution at Monday's council meeting spelling out a proposal that would set the city's 2025 levy on your property taxes to be billed at 2026 at $17.73 million, up 6% over the 2024 levy of $16.73 million. The council passed the resolution 4-3, saying it would be the limit of what they might help themselves to from taxpayer wallets, but the sentiment of the meeting was clear they'd be happier if there was another solution. Legal rules mean the council had to get the resolution passed, setting the stage for a public hearing on November 17th on the adoption of the budget, followed by another public hearing and the adoption of the property tax levy December 1st. So it's far from being all said and done yet, and major Mayor Julie Moore Wolf assured council members there would be discussions and consultations with the council's professional staff to look at other ways to come up with the needed cash. I mean, none of us want to pay more for our tax bills either, and so we understand that, she said. The city manager and the treasurer are going to meet individually with us to look at some alternatives. So when we absolutely still have work to do to see what kind of savings can happen and what makes the most sense that the majority of us are willing to support, because I don't think anybody is excited about the possibility of raising any taxes. Interim City Treasurer and Director of Finance Greg Zantara has pointed out that the city is actually proposing to meet its needs by keeping its share of your property tax bill around 16%, relatively flat year over year, but the amount of money collected rises anyway if the levy is left alone to reflect an increase in the assessed valuation of homes and businesses. Among the big expenses driving the need for more funds in city coffers are the escalating costs of paying the police pension bill, rising from $6.93 million to $7.58 million, and firefighter pensions increasing from $5.65 million to $6.24 million. And for 2025, paying police and fire pensions accounted for more than 74% of the total City of Decatur property tax bill. But council members David Horn, Ed Culp, Lisa Gregory, and Dennis Cooper all said collecting more from strapped taxpayers wasn't the way to fix the money woes. The residents of Decatur are already taxed enough, said Horn. We have got to make the conclusion that already elevated levels of property tax and then increasing the amount of property taxes collected is not going to solve our long-term challenges. He suggested instead raiding reserve funds or implementing across-the-board 1% cuts in all city departments. Gregory said asking more from taxpayers is not something I can support, and Culp said the financial situation for families and businesses was already bad all over, and the city must think again about what it's doing. I'm not sure that those working on the budget, professional staff, have heard the council, said Cooper. We really do not want to raise taxes, and we need to have some options permitted to us that show no taxes being raised. Zantara said other options would be forthcoming to balance the books, and personally suggested raiding the city's hefty 90-day cash reserve. You know, many of us don't think the city needs a 90-day cash reserve, he said. He pointed out, however, that the extra $1 million coming into the budget from current tax levy proposal was from increases in valuation, which he considered the city ought to benefit from. And Councilmember Pat McDonald worried about how the city budget would fare amid clawbacks from a state government facing its own massive deficit and anxious to grab a bigger share of the tax and revenue pie. McDaniel said the taxpayers who complain about property taxes also want your potholes filled. You want your streets fixed. He believed that maintaining the city and improving it is ultimately good for everyone living in Decatur. That looks good for potential new businesses that want to come to Decatur because they look at infrastructure, he said. So if we can let everything go to pot or we can stay on top of it, once you do not do a lot of this infrastructure, it costs more down the road. State Senator Turner visits Hayworth as principal for a day by Matusik Janik. A local state senator took some time away from her work in Springfield to walk in the shoes of a principal at one of Central Illinois' top schools. This is a small community school with big things happening, and I think that's exactly what we saw here today, said State Senator Sally Turner, Republican of Beeson, on Monday. Turner joined Hayworth principal April Hicklin for a special principal for a day visit. They walked the halls and checked on the students at Hayworth Junior and Senior High School at 308 West Cleveland Street. This visit is part of the Illinois Principals Association annual Principal for a Day program, which connects state and local leaders with schools to provide an inside look at the daily responsibilities, challenges, and successes of school leadership. I wanted her to get a glimpse of what we're actually doing in schools in Hayworth, Hicklin said. We are a small rural district, but we have big things happening. During the visit, Turner visited the classroom, met with students and staff, observed instructional practices and student engagement, and learned more about the school's programs and initiatives. Her visit came just after the high school learned it had earned an exemplary designation on the 2025 Illinois School Report Card, the highest rating awarded by the Illinois State Board of Education, and recognizes schools that perform in the top 10% statewide. Hicklin credits her staff and the community for being supportive throughout the years and helping students get out the door and ready for college and careers in their next chapter. But like most other area schools, she said the shortage of teachers is continuing to be a challenge. "We're having a difficult time filling positions that we used to be able to have a ton of applicants for," Hicklin said. "Now we're lucky if we get one or two. I would say all schools in Illinois need some help with the teacher shortage." Turner said this has been an issue that the state legislature has started to work on for the last 4 years, or since the pandemic, with ideas like public service loan forgiveness programs. "That's just one step, but I think it's really important that we help lift up teachers and let them know that being in public service is an honor. And I think sometimes some of the individuals in public service feel like they're looked down on, Turner said. "EMTs, policemen, teachers, all those people that are right out there in the front, they have difficulties with that." Turner also had a chance to answer questions from seniors in a short town hall, led in part by Ryan Lawler, a social studies teacher and head basketball coach, girls basketball coach who previously served on the McLean County Board. Lawler coordinated the discussion among various senior students who asked Turner about relationships across political parties, education, and community support systems. Food assistance for families was among the topics discussed, which has been at the forefront since SNAP benefits were at risk of being halted at the start of November amid the ongoing federal government shutdown. The Trump administration said Monday it will use emergency funds to partially fund SNAP benefits for November, but other funds will not be used to provide complete coverage, according to the Capital News Illinois. "This partial funding means that more than one in six Illinois residents who rely on SNAP to buy groceries each month will get a smaller than normal share and have to wait an unknown amount of time for their cards to be reloaded with funds." "Pass the bill. Let's move on," Turner said of the pending federal budget. "It's pretty easy. Let's just do it and get it over with, and then have the discussion about what the tweaks are that you want to make afterwards." Turner added that this is also a time when communities react and help their neighbors in need, whether through local churches, food pantries, or other community organizations. The state senator also spoke about Senate Bill 2706, which she sponsored when it was filed about 2 weeks ago. The bill would lower property taxes by increasing the real property cost basis used to assess wind and solar farms. This bill would raise the tax from $360,000 per megawatt of capacity to $588,000 for wind and $288,000 to $446,000 for solar. Turner said solar and wind companies are getting too many subsidies and the tax base for these companies needs to be redone. "We need to go back to what the Clean Grid Alliance was when it first started and give local control back so that these counties can navigate the waters that are best for them, because in some places you're not able to expand your city," Turner said. "If you have that limitation where a solar farm was just put in, but the city can't grow any further, how does that help your EAV?" "It doesn't." Man ends up in hospital following violent arrest by immigrant agents in Chicago, family says, by Adriana Perez from the Chicago Tribune. A man was hospitalized and remains in federal custody after being arrested by immigration agents in suburban Melrose Park on Sunday morning, his family told the Tribune. As of Sunday evening, they had not been allowed to see him and they had received no updates on his condition. Video shared on social media show Ricardo Aguayo Rodriguez, 53, struggling on the ground, lying next to a white truck, while a federal agent kept him in a headlock. "Por favor, amigo," he can be heard pleading as he groans and yells in pain. "Please, friend." The Department of Homeland Security could not be immediately reached for comment. Dora Swain, his older sister, told the Tribune in Spanish that two agents were standing guard outside his room when she arrived at Loyola Medicine's Gottlieb Memorial Hospital. They wouldn't let her in, but she caught a glance from the doorway and saw her brother in bed with bandages on his face and head. "They didn't even say anything to us," she said. A hospital spokesperson said in an emailed statement, "Loyola Medicine treats federal agencies like the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement the same way we treat all local enforcement personnel. If they need to enter our facilities, they coordinate with our security team. This morning, ICE personnel came to Gottlieb Memorial Hospital to accompany a patient in their custody who required medical care. Visitation is restricted for any patient in custody and is at the discretion of the law enforcement agency." Hospital staff have been in contact with the family to update them on the patient's condition. Law enforcement does not need a warrant to be present in the building when someone is already in their custody, a hospital official on site Sunday told advocates. According to Swain, her brother had left home on his bicycle in the morning to get some food when agents picked him up near 17th Avenue and Main Street. They hit him on the face and head. They were almost choking him, Swain said. Witnesses told her that Aguayo Rodriguez was taken to the hospital after complaining of chest pain. Videos from the scene at 17th and Main shared to a neighborhood Facebook page show vehicles and an ambulance driving away as emergency sirens wail. Brian Orzorko, an attorney at Gregory Collison Associates, was retained by the family Sunday night to represent them. He told the Tribune he had formally submitted a request to DHS to meet with his client, but had yet to hear back. Based on the video that we have, he was bleeding on his forehead, Orzorko said. Original from Zacatecas, Texas, Mexico, Aguayo Rodriguez has been in the country since the 1980s. He has a construction job and is the father of two children, ages 5 and 7. Él es bien trabajador, Swain said, which translates to he is a hard worker. A local rapid response from team confirmed federal immigration enforcement activity across the village of Melrose Park that resulted in at least 3 arrests Sunday, including that of Aguayo Rodriguez. The Office of State Representative Norma Hernandez, whose district includes Melrose Park, also confirmed sightings along the village's Lake Street, as well as the 3 arrests and the hospitalization. Hernandez said agents had been present in nearby North Lake and Addison. In light of this incident and other recent ICE activity in the district, we urge all residents to exercise extreme caution while walking, driving, or commuting through these areas. It is crucial to stay aware of your surroundings and to understand your rights, a post shared by Hernandez's office read. The western suburbs have been hit hard as part of President Donald Trump's Operation Midway Blitz in the Chicago area. 2 months ago, a man, Silverio Villegas Gonzalez, was shot and killed by an ICE agent during a traffic stop in Franklin Park, and strong-arm tactics have become the norm among federal immigration agents in the city and its suburbs. Community leaders have planned a training for rapid response volunteers at the Maywood Public Library on Tuesday, organized by the Paso West Suburban Action Project, Representative Hernandez and House Speaker Emmanuel Chris Welsh. Council charges ahead with EV chargers. Decatur. When it comes to public places to plug in and charge your electric vehicle, Decatur remains something of a voltage desert. But all that is about to change after City Council voted Monday evening to charge ahead with spending $821,000 installing 10 chargers at locations dotted around the city. 2 chargers will be plugged in outside the Civic Center, another 2 will be at Decatur Public Library, 2 more will be near Lake Decatur at Nelson Park, and 4 chargers will be stationed in Fairview Park. The chargers at the Civic Center Library in Nelson Park will be Level 3 models, capable of fully juicing up a vehicle in 45 minutes or less. The 4 chargers in Fairview Park will be Level 2, which need about 8 hours to zap your typical EV battery back to its full strength. The huge cost of all this work is being paid for with 100% grant money funneled through the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, Ameren Illinois, and the Department of Transportation. They all appear amped up to help because, according to the interim city manager Melissa Hahn, Decatur gets a far from glowing report card on EV charger availability. These investments align with the city's EV readiness plan and national guidance from the U.S. Department of Energy's Alternative Fuels Data Center, both of which highlight that Decatur currently lags behind regional peers in providing publicly accessible infrastructure, she said in a memo to the council. Expanding EV access will support residents, visitors, and the city's long-term sustainability goals. The council voted unanimously to install the chargers, and work is expected to begin as soon as this week, but the pace of current affairs, however, may have already left them behind. In a June survey by the American Automobile Association found that just 16% of adults in the nation are either very likely or even likely to purchase a fully electric vehicle as their next ride. That's the lowest level of interest recorded since 2019. Potential buyers cite the higher cost of EVs and significantly anxiety over the lack of a convenient and reliable network of public chargers. Drivers were also concerned about long charging times when asked to list reasons for bypassing battery cars while vehicle shopping. ADM reports $108 million net income. Archer Daniels Midland Company on Tuesday reported third quarter net income of $108 million. On a per-share basis, the Chicago-based company said it had net income of 22 cents. Earnings, adjusted for asset impairment costs and non-recurring costs, were 92 cents per share. The results beat Wall Street expectations. The average estimate of three analysts surveyed by Zacks Investment Research was for earnings of 89 cents per share. The agribusiness giant posted revenues of $20.37 billion in the period. ADM expects full-year earnings in the range of $3.25 to $3.50 per share. During the third quarter, we made solid progress in areas within our control as we navigated a highly dynamic global environment. We advanced our portfolio organization initiatives, accomplished cost savings through targeted streamlining, efficiently ran our plants, and generated robust cash flow, said Juan Luciano, chair of the board and CEO. Looking forward, we expect biofuel policy clarity and trade policy evolution to provide demand signals for our industry. However, based on the environment since our last earnings call, we are revisiting our 2025 full-year expectations primarily to reflect lower crush margins. We are in a company built to endure cycles, and our asset network, combined with our skilled workforce, will remain a source of reliable strength for our farmers, customers, partners, and investors. ADM shares have climbed 19% since the beginning of the year, while the S&P's 500 index has risen 16%. The stock has risen 10% in the last 12 months. Video gaming burglar gets 7 years. A serial catalytic converter thief who switched to burglarizing video gaming machines has been sentenced to 7 years in prison. Mitchell Reno Chapman appeared October 30th in Macon County Circuit Court and took a plea deal that saw him admit to a single charge of burglary. A second burglary charge was dropped as part of the agreement. Sworn affidavits and arrest warrants filed by the Decatur Police Department and the Macon County Sheriff's Office described Chapman with various helpers launching a series of raids on businesses in and around Decatur. In just one day, January 6th, the 39-year-old defendant from Blue Mound is accused of burglarizing Debbie's Video Slots and Poker, 3611 East US 36, and then hitting Whit's End Restaurant at 3663 East William Street Road. Detectives also believed he was linked to another burglary at the Disabled American Veterans Club, 1700 North Lakeshore Drive, which happened just 10 minutes before Debbie's crime. Decatur Police Detective Jason Kutschelmeister, who wrote one of the arrest warrants for Chapman, said the burglary stole thousands of dollars and left huge damage bills. He said video surveillance showed sledgehammers and pry bars being used to rip apart the gaming machines and their cash boxes. A check of Chapman's criminal record shows that he had been sentenced to 3 years in prison in October of 2022 after pleading guilty to the systematic theft of catalytic converters, an expensive part of the vehicle exhaust system. Imposing the 7-year burglary sentence at the October 30th sentencing hearing, presiding judge Thomas Griffith had agreed to recommend Chapman for substance abuse treatment while he is incarcerated. The judge also agreed that the defendant's sentence will be reduced by more than 70 days with credits, which include serving as a trustee while held in the jail. Hints from Heloise, stockpiling food for the winter. Dear Heloise, it comes as no surprise that groceries are getting a lot more expensive. Where I live, we are often snowed in for a few days during the winter, or the roads get so bad that it's nearly impossible to get to a grocery store. So, starting in September, I began to stockpile food that will not perish for a long time, such as canned chili, canned soups, pasta, and various sauces or materials to make a sauce. Items such as laundry soap, hand soap, toilet paper, paper towels, and shampoo can be stored in plastic bins or cardboard boxes in the garage. And food items are stored under beds, in closets, or in any place with a little extra room. I buy a little at a time, and this way it's not such a strain of our budget. So, even if it doesn't snow, we have a rather lean month. I can still feed my family. And that was sent in by Casey J. from Montana. And that's the end of part one of the Decatur Herald and Review. I'll be back in a minute.